Hi, welcome to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 4, season 2, I speak with Kelly Lee Evans, an amazing award-winning singer and motivational speaker. During the call, she gives us the gift of an incredible a cappella performance of one of her most requested songs in her repertoire. We speak about the many challenges she's faced, including two near-death experiences. This podcast is also available in video format, and the link is in the description. Please follow this podcast so you can be informed of all the new episodes with an interesting mix of musicians and their stories of a life in music. Hi, Kelly Lee Evans. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just really admire your singing and your power as a performer. And I know you have a new album out, which we're going to talk about a little later. But I thought to put that in context, it'd be really good for people that don't know your story and your singing to talk a little bit about how you got started in singing.
For sure, so, yeah.
I heard that when you were growing up, your mom was a member of the Record of the Month Club.
She was. She was. And so that meant that we had a lot of different albums and different styles. You know, I remember like there'd be like Boxcar Willie and, you know, they would just send things that you know, you had no idea what you were getting. So I would go through them because I was a latchkey kid. My mom was a single mom. She was a nurse. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of hours on your own, you know? Yeah. And I would just, the record player and I were friends.
Would you sing along?
For sure. Yeah. I've been singing since kindergarten, at least, you know, I've been singing publicly since kindergarten. And I'm sure I was probably singing, I can't even tell you like when I started singing, but the first public performance, my first performance was when I was in kindergarten, a solo for the school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So were you taking voice lessons or in choir?
Oh, gosh, no. No. I might have been, like, I ended up being in choir that I can remember, you know, like, so probably it was just like little things that the school would organize. So if we had a choir in your class, I would be part of that. But I wasn't a part of the school choir per se I wasn't even in, you know, in high school. I ended up being a part of the Toronto Mendelssohn Youth Choir. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was after school. My family, you know, wasn't big on me getting into music per se, you know, like they were big on me. Okay. It was okay for me to be like an all around student, which I was. And so I got into as many different clubs and things as I could, but it was really important to not, as they used to say, waste a credit. Mm. And so, yeah, I wasn't in choir. I didn't take any lessons. In the beginning, it was funny because my mom, she was my cousin, but I called her my aunt. So my aunt at the time, she knew us a vocal coach, and the vocal coach didn't think that you should start training until you were 16 and your voice had changed. So I waited and I wanted so badly, but like once that had been laid down that, you know, it wasn't going to happen. So I never got any lessons, and then my voice changed and I still didn't go and take lessons. Cause by then, you know, I was almost finished school and the focus was really to just graduate and get out of high school and get right into university.
Mm-hmm. So just to backtrack a little bit with the Record of the Month Club, because for, you know, people growing up now, it's like, well, they kind of relate to that, right?
Music. Like, what's a record?
Well, not only that, but just the fact that it wasn't so easily accessible. If you put on the radio, it was often top 40 stuff. It wouldn't be more eclectic choices. So it's a powerful thing. Your mom must have loved music to have been a member of this club.
She really did, you know, and what was so interesting to me was, and when I think back, when payday came, we would go to the grocery store. So we'd go to two different grocery stores. You'd go to like the regular grocery store where you get like milk, you know, regular bread, cheese, chicken, whatever. But then we'd also go to the West Indian grocery store where you get different types of food that, you know, are like important to my culture, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we went to the record shop, mm-hmm. you know, like that was a part of the like my bi-weekly routine was to go, and she would like, you know, go through what was coming out, and we'd get like the latest soca album or the latest calypso or reggae, and all the records that I have now are my mom's records. Like I don't think I've ever bought a record myself. Like, or I mean, I did later on, like as a teenager, but I pulled out this box of records, and I remember I had culled it at one point of stuff like I was never going to listen to. I wish I had never touched it, but I after she died, you know, there's an important shedding, you know, that needs to happen, or else you're carrying like many, many households. And so I went through just with and took the albums that meant the most to me, and I pulled them out over the summer, and I bought a record player. And I was just going through the stuff that I can remember being in the record shop. Cause like back then you could ask, you know, could you play this? And they might play the, you know, the album, and then we'd buy it and bring it home. And then that would be what would be playing. And my mom wasn't big on setting it up the record player herself. That was my job. So I would be in charge of the stereo, you know, and I would be in charge of the music. I was the DJ at the house.
What were some of those special albums that you saved?
I saved like these Calypso albums. Those were my favorite, like Byron Lee and the Dragonaires. There was an amazing one from Rita Marley called One Draw that I just loved. And it's funny because I was listening back to it, and I called up my god sister, and I was just playing them for her, because that was another part of my childhood, was being in her basement during like parties. So like, you know, if you were having, it could be Christmas, we'd all get together for Christmas, and then everybody go down to the basement, and my uncle, who's now passed, well, he's my godfather, he would play these albums. And so we were just reminiscing on our childhood, of just like how much a part of our childhood music was, and being down there and just listening to them play the records, and is how it can just like boom, take you back, you know? Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Yeah, so the ones that I went to happened to be all of those, like Calypso, like really like party music, really, because that was like, you know, what was so important to me at that time. And it's funny too, like how that experience of being a DJ at the house affected my career, in the sense that when we got, my mom got her first car that had like a cassette player, she wanted me to take her Nina Simone albums and put them onto cassette. And like, people also won't understand just like how, like just everything involved in trying to record from that mode of audio, like a vinyl LP to a cassette, where you've got to like get the music on, get the needle in the right place, get press record at the right time, have this proper distance between the speaker and the recording device, you know, and make sure that you get it. And then if it skips, what do you do? And have to re-record. And through that, like, I had to learn all like about my mom's like Nina Simone albums, because I was just listening over and over and over again so I could make this cassette tape that she could play in the car. And it's from there that, you know, because at that time I hadn't, like, it was listening to Nina that with my mom, I was like, oh, you know, like I wasn't sure how much I enjoyed her. And that experience also like was just like imprinting her music into my life. And then also my ex-husband, he was a huge Nina Simone fan, and he would play her music all the time too. So just being around music so much through others as well really shaped me and shaped my career, because then I went on to make this tribute album to Nina based on all these songs that I had learned from listening to her.
Yeah, that was your first album, right?
That was my fourth album. Yeah, my first album was an album called Fight or Flight. Then I did a live version, which actually recorded at the NAC. And then the third one was called The Good Girl, and then Nina. So Nina and The Good Girl were kind of made around the same time, released around the same time. And then, yeah, my first album, Fight or Flight, was nominated for Juno. And then Nina was nominated and won. And then after Nina, we had I Remember When, Come On. And that was nominated again. And now we're coming up to the next one.
When you started working with the record label in France, were they all with that label, or was Nina the first with that?
Nina was the first and only with that label. And that label's now since closed. Yeah. So that album is just like floating. It's out in the ether. You know, the label went bankrupt. And so it's just the music, the masters is sitting there. Yeah.
Well, so you've mentioned your mom, and you lost her quite young.
That yeah.
So hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I think even more so because you know, when she left Jamaica in the 60s and went to study in, like, just to become a midwife in England. And it's funny because I watch Call the Midwife now, and there's a character there that, you know, went from Jamaica, and I think back to, like, you know, that experience, because that same godparents that I was telling you about, she met my godmother there when she was studying. So she was studying to be a nurse midwife, and she ended up coming here to Canada, and my godmother came as well, and another godmother came. So it was like the three of them. But other than that, I didn't have, like, really a lot of family here, you know, in Canada. My dad's brother lived here for a while, but then he moved away. So I was really on my own when she left, and I was an only child. And so everybody was either in the States, England, Jamaica, wherever, but it was just me here. And so, yeah, it really did affect me, being, like, an only child, and also having that incredible light, you know, gone. Because even if she didn't, like, 100% support music, it wasn't because, like, she didn't believe music was awesome. It was just she really wanted me to be okay. You know, I think now as a parent, I can look back and be like, yeah, I totally get it. You know, she wanted to make sure that I was gonna be set, because she knew how hard it is to be, you know, a human without funds. You know, that's not an easy thing.
So you were doing your master's in law.
Yeah. Well, I was doing my master's, so it was my MA in legal philosophy here at Carleton University. And so my bachelor's is in, it's weird because, like, I'm looking at it, it's Bachelor of Arts, Honors in Law. And then I have another one, Bachelor of Arts, English with distinction. Yeah. So those are my undergrads. And then I was interested at the time in minority rights and representation, and in legal philosophy. And so I was doing my Master's of Arts in Law. Yeah. But I mean, my parents, their hope, I think, would have been like, you know, just like most immigrant parents, like a lawyer, doctor, engineer, you know. And I tried, you know, to like, I wasn't trying that hard though, like, to really be a lawyer. I really was hiding in school, you know. Like, my goal was just to be like, just keep my head down and stay here as long as possible, because school's awesome. And if you figured out the path, like, if you know, like, what to do, you attend, you finish the assignments, you hand them in. You do the study, you do the reading, you get a mark, everybody's happy. You know, it's like, that's something that's, you know, very doable, I think, if you can just follow the script. And but real life outside of school is scary, you know. And the music industry, like, what's the path? What's the path?
And your path was unusual. So
Yeah.
you to study jazz, vocal jazz, you had this sort of study plan by month. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that it's so funny, because I think that's just like my like the obsessive aspect of my personality is just to, like, break it down into a system, you know, and to say, like, okay, well, I had met somebody that said, you know, oh, jazz would be too difficult for you to learn. And I was like, oh, really? And so I decided I was gonna, you know, learn. And I went, and I kind of just decided, like, every single month I'm gonna study one person. And back then we had, like, not Napster, but Kazaa was like a way that you could listen to lots of, you know, like, it was like a file sharing company. And so you could just listen to, like, everything under the world. iTunes wasn't there yet, and I would go to the library, and I would get, like, the biography. So, for instance, like, say, to this is November. November might be Mel Torme month, you know. And so I'd get, like, if there's any biographies written on Mel Torme or autobiography, I would get it and I would read it. I would listen to all of his CDs, as many as I could. I would just find out as much information as I could about him online. It was his month. As soon as that month was over, you know, December might be Sarah Vaughan. Down into the Sarah Vaughan I go. And I think for the first year, it was mainly just focusing on different singers. And then I thought, you know, like, I should open it up and listen and, like, learn about musicians. And all this is while I'm trying to also do my degree. But it's funny because, like, I look back now and I'm like, who was that? You know, like, yeah, like, that I was capable of, like, doing, like, this crazy reading for legal studies, like Habermas and, like, Foucault and all these different thinkers who, like, right now I'd be like, what are they saying? But back then, I mean, I was still saying, what are they saying? But like, I was writing papers about what they were saying. Don't give me any of that to look at now. And like, able to do that, I had jobs, you know. At one point, my mom was sick, and I was traveling back and forth to Toronto to check in on, like, to take her to radiation or to take her to dialysis. Then I was driving back. I was TAing courses here. I was taking courses. I was writing, and I was doing all that and going back and forth every week. Like, who was that? You know, like, I tried to take a course I audited a course with Mark Ferguson a couple years back before the pandemic. And like, he's an awesome, for anybody listening there, he's an awesome pianist and an awesome teacher. And also James McGowan, I did some courses with him just on music theory. And I was like, I could barely keep up with the classwork of one little half credit. I looked at these students, you know, going to all these courses, and I couldn't imagine, you know, going back to school and trying to take on that stress of learning and reading and thinking and you know, of course I didn't have kids back then, so that might also, you know, and I didn't have as many responsibilities and a career, but yeah, it's a different world.
So the Thelonious Monk Jazz Competition is like very prestigious, very important jazz competition. You were runner up. So this really helped launch your career, didn't it?
Yeah, that was a big moment. It was a big moment. It was a big stage. You know, we performed at the Kennedy Center and in front of like people like Colin Powell and just a lot of dignitaries in the US. And it was a big moment also because here I was meeting some of these people I'd been studying about, you know, like the judges at the time were like Dede Bridgewater, Kurt Elling, Al Jarreau, Flora Purim, Quincy Jones. You know, that it was a serious group. Little Jimmy Scott, you know, we had, and then that's just the people judging you on, you know, you'd be in the elevator with Wayne Shorter. I remember getting in an elevator with Herbie Hancock, and he said, Kelly Lee Evans. And I was like, oh my God, you know, it was just like this very surreal moment and brush with some of these stars. And it was, I think that, you know, that little step up where they just kind of pulled you up a little to so that you could see that this is what it looks like and this is where you could go. And they've been wonderful, you know, to me over the years in inviting me to be part of the teaching faculty on in Chicago with some younger students and to come back on stage and perform and be a part of. They brought me to Jazz Day in Paris and was able to perform with Hugh Masekela. Who's sadly passed away recently, and they just create these moments where, you know, you get a chance to shine amongst like the people at the upper echelon of the music. So it's been very, very humbling and nice and yeah, it's exactly what my career needed right at the moment it needed it.
And on the, so you mentioned on the jury panel, there were two women, Dede Bridgewater and Flora Purim. So you were a mom at that point already.
Yes, yeah.
Did you talk to them about the challenges?
I sure did. And you know, it's funny because I was just I just woke up this morning and there was a message from Didi and she was just telling me about this mentorship program that she started. And I mean, like, I don't know if she knows like how much of a mentor she was for me, you know, at that time and over the years just being able to ask her questions here and there and I got to talk to her daughter and find out like what it was like for her well both of her daughters yeah find out what it's like for them being the children of a touring artist and Flora as well gave me lots of great tips and would meet with me when I was in the States and check in on me as well. So it's funny, I was just thinking about her recently because I haven't talked to her in many years. So it's yeah, mentorship and especially female mentorship in a business that's very male oriented is so important because I think a lot of people don't think like so many people ask me now, like, oh, it must be so hard for you, like during the pandemic to like not be on the road. And I'm like, nope, I love it. Like, because I get to stay home with my family and they really do need me. And it's like, it's the age when, you know, I mean, like all ages are when parent, kids need parents, but this is like a pretty tender age. And this has been just like a blessing for me to be able to be home and find other ways to create, as opposed to being away and being like, geez, like what's going on? You know, I'm wishing that I could be there. So yeah, it's the musician's life, it's important, and it's important for us to, I think, to be able to be there for one another. That's another nice thing that happened to me during the pandemic. I had my friend Shakura Saida, who's a blues singer based in Toronto, amazing blues singer. She started a group, you know, of other female band leaders, you know, women of color that would get together on a weekly basis throughout the pandemic. And now we meet less frequently, but that was so amazing to be able to talk to others, in some cases, other mothers, other people, and like, what are you doing? How are you doing? And these constant check-ins, like this pandemic has also created like a way, like a way to connect as a community that didn't quite exist in the same way, because we didn't even know that we had the need for it.
So your career was really taking off, and you're touring a lot in Europe, and you're doing a lot of work in France, I believe. You had a couple of near-death experiences. You're very famous for the lightning strike,
Yeah.
but before that, you had a really scary experience as well.
I did. It was back in, I want to say 2002. Yeah, it was right before it's actually what started me in the business, you know. And so I hadn't really thought of it from that perspective as being, it's like the catalyst of like how I really got started. Yeah, I think it was around 2002, maybe early 2003. I was playing tennis, and I had an ankle roll over. And like the people may not know like what that is. It's like when you hear like the ligaments go, you know, and it's very audible and very horrible. I went to the hospital, and they diagnosed it, and they told me to go home and have Advil. And I had no idea that I was allergic to Advil, because when I was growing up, like they always just said, like, don't give your kids aspirin, give your kids Tylenol. So my mom like always gave me Tylenol. I've never had aspirin. And but it was for the, you know, inflammation. Picked up some on the way home from the hospital, got home, took it, and my face swelled up like I was like Will Smith in Hitch, you know, and rushed back to the hospital. And they pumped me full of adrenaline, and I remember passing out and waking up, and you know, I went back home, and so basically, like at the time, the part that I don't really share as much is that like I had gone to this guru before, like because I had some problems with my voice. And I was blocked, and this lady who helped artists who were blocked. And so she was like, well, I want you to make a list of like all the things that you want to do, you know? And I was just like, what even is that? You know? Because like up to then, it was just like, well, we just do what other people tell us to do. You know, we do what's going to make other people happy. We keep everybody stays happy. And so I had written like kind of just like my dream bucket list, and I had always wanted to learn to play tennis. And so tennis was on the list, learn to write a song was on the list, you know, be a musician was on the list. At this point, my mom had passed away. I was a mom to a 2-year-old. And I had that on that list, you know, and my husband at the time said to me, like when we got back home, he was like, that ball could have hit you in the throat. You know, he said, you know, ne I never, like in all time we'd been together since at that point, since I was 16. He was like, and the whole time we've been together, I never heard you say you wanted to play tennis. You know, he was like, why don't you write a song? Because I'd had like in the living room, I'd had this pile of books on songwriting because I'm a researcher, and I'd had this pile of books on tennis, and I kept looking at the tennis books. And he was like, why don't you write a song? And I was like, fine then. And so I was, because I was still recuperating on the couch, I was still all swollen, and I pick up this book. It's probably like Songwriting for Dummies. And I wrote my first songs, and all of those songs became like the music on my first album that was ended up being nominated for the Juno.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was just like Yeah, I guess it's funny because I never thought like, yeah, that led to that, but that totally led to that. Yeah.
And so then, a few years later, when you're washing
Yeah.
dishes, right?
Washing my dishes in my house in the country, and during a lightning storm, and the lightning hit the roof of the house and went down through the pipes, and that was just the moment that my hand hit the edge of the sink, and then the charge just went through my body, and this just totally changed my life, you know, forever. And yeah, it's never I never felt the same. What's really cool, like I have cool things happening right now for me. Just like I think, like I never gave up, but I gave up a bit, you know, and that like my left side just never felt right, you know, because it was very stroke-like, the effects. And then I started going to physio again at the beginning of this year. And they had been working on stuff because, like, sometimes my hands would like kind of twist in, and not kind of, they would twist in, and they would be hard. It's so funny because I can hardly do it now because they're getting strong again. I'm not affected right now, and so we were working on that, and that we did all that. Like every time I would go in, she would check on that to make sure that they were still behaving and staying straight, and being able to do this is really awesome, like because my hands kind of pull in, and but she was like, well, what do you want to work on today? And I realized like I never really talk about my left leg and my left side. And I just kind of take it in that like I'm just, you know, differently abled. I'm not going to be able to like use my left side as I can as others or as I could. And she started working with me on it. And then I started to also go to my osteopath because I'm like, I'm seeing results. Like to be able to move my foot and to twist my foot, you know, and turn my ankle. And this week to be able to be on tiptoes on my left side, it's like, what is happening? So to feel all of that, I just feel like, oh, like think good things are happening. I'm so excited to feel like more freedom of movement through my left side, and to see like, you know, like the development happening on my left side is really amazing. So yes, really good things. So yeah, it's been, and that's since 2013. It's a long time. You know, like 8 years of thinking that the effects from that lightning were permanent, like, and maybe they still are permanent, but like, it doesn't mean that they can't improve.
Yeah, well, that's really great to hear about that progress.
Thank you.
So, with all these difficulties you've faced and this courage you've mustered and your creativity, you have another career you've started as a motivational speaker, is that right?
Yeah, I think because, you know, I would do interviews like this and people would say, wow, can you come and tell my staff about it, you know, or would you come and talk to my students about it? And so I started getting these phone calls after I would do an interview on the CBC or on Canada, you know, back in the day, Canada AM. People would start calling me and I would be like, oh, sure. And I would just come in. And so I've had the chance to, you know, speak to students and to adults, you know, across the, well, I can say across the world. You know, I've done these speeches too, like in Martinique and in Haiti. And it's funny, like it's been a blessing, you know? Yeah, it's been a blessing. So wait, did I do it in Martinique? I want to just say Haiti. Let's just say Haiti. There was another country I had done one in, but yeah, it's been a blessing to be able to talk to people because like you get to share your story, that's really special. But then in the question and answer part, like people start to share their story and you get to see like how alike so many of us are, and that, you know, that thread of humanity just keeps passing through. And when you hear people just respond, you know, like wow, like that's you know, exactly what I've been feeling, or that's what happened, and like I haven't been able to talk about it, or it's just it's a beautiful it's a beautiful job in that way. You know, the songwriting aspect, it's like I get to say things maybe that some other people may not want to say, but they're feeling. I get to make music that can touch somebody on a specific day, music that can grow with a person, you know. Like a friend of mine called and she'd just put her CD player back together. Because not a lot of people have CDs right anymore. She put her CD player back together and she found one of my first CDs and she was singing and she started to just tell me about like where she was when she remembered hearing that CD and just how it can take you back. And it's just like, I mean, you know, you're a musician as well, like how we can be a part of people's lives in these moments. And you know, it's a very lucky, humbling, blessed position to be in, I think.
So I was just listening to the album you made with the Roddy Elias songs, Not This Room.
Oh my goodness. I love that project so much.
Yeah. So he was on, for people who haven't heard my conversation with him, it's in season one. And yeah, he's a guitarist and composer. And he had talked in that conversation about he was writing the songs at that time. I was so moved to listen. I mean, you're such an incredible performer, and your delivery of Sandra's beautiful words and the whole way all the instrumentation was done. It's an incredible album that's about the pandemic experience.
Thank you. I feel moved, you know, whenever I sing it or listen to it, or you know, just to think. Yeah, because when Roddy wrote me about it, I just said yes, you know. I just said, yeah, sure. Yeah, Roddy. You know, the same way I said yes for his last project that we worked on together, which was the puppet opera, Sleeping Rough. I didn't know what was gonna come out of it, you know, and like when you hear the music and then you read the text and then you get out of your head, because like there's a learning aspect for me, like where it's like, okay, like first I'm not really so focused on the text, I'm more focused on like learning the notes, because Roddy's music isn't just like boom, you listen one time and you've got it, unless maybe like you're a genius, you know, like I need to sit with it for a long while and learn it, like truly learn it. And so then like adding in the layer of the text and singing, you're like, okay, like I need to really, that's just even before you get to the rehearsal, you know? It's like, so I've got it, I'm here. And now to get out of the like, oh, I'm making mistakes, you know, like for to get out of that and then now get into the actual experience of the music, then you're like, wow, you know, like you feel the wow of it. And then when I got back the edits, you know, the mixes. And I was sitting here with my daughter and we were listening and we were like, just like jaw-droppingly beautiful. People, if you know, if you can find it, it's on Bandcamp under Roddy Elias, Ellias. And he's a genius. He really is. And his wife, Sandra, she's a genius. And the words that they use to describe these, you know, commonplace experiences that we've all, well, for many of us that have gone through over these past 2 years. They're poignant, they're, you know, touching, they're beautiful, and they're true, you know? Yeah.
And very challenging vocal lines he wrot for you at
Oh my God, Roddy.
extremes of your voices. And I have to, you mentioned Sleeping Rough, which I discussed with him in my conversation with him, which I heard you live. It was so incredibly moving. And you memorized the whole thing, and
Yeah.
your delivery was so powerful. How did you memorize that?
It was the only choice because I didn't know how to read music, right? So I had to memorize it. So it was like all of that was in my head. I was saying to Roddy, I was like, darn it. Because okay, so I told you that I went to go and audit courses, you know, in music. That was because of doing Sleeping Rough. I was so like taken. I was actually, what happened was I was out doing a music camp in Saskatchewan, in Saskatoon, for the Saskatoon Jazz Festival. And I was with the students and I was just telling them like just how, not to say that I envied them, but I found it like so amazing that they could be the ages that they were, so you know, high school age, early university, and they could choose music just like that. Like they could just say like, I'm just gonna do music, and their parents were like, okay, here's the money, you know what I mean? Or they'd be like, yeah, sure, like that's totally cool. And so they were all there and they just took it for granted, like it's just like that's okay, and for them to be there. And I was like, wow, like I would have loved to have that level of like just like, yeah, go do it, go be you, you know? And so I came away from it, and at the time I'm here trying to learn Roddy's project, Sleeping Rough, and I'm memorizing it like note for note, you know, and line for line. So I said, when I go back home, I'm gonna take music. Like, I want to learn to read music. And so that's what I did. I signed up. And then now, like, I have to read the music. Like, when I was doing Roddy's project, I'm like, shoot, I could have had this memorized, but instead of memorizing it, I'm like reading along. Because like now I'm doing, it's not even fully reading, it's like a somewhere in between, where it's just like the reading is guiding me, but I miss when I just like internalize the songs. And I'm sure like if I actually stepped away from the music, it'd be fine, but I have so much fear, respect for Roddy's music. I want it to come across in the best way possible, and so now I'm like, well, I can read it, so let me do it. Yeah, I'm still not like awesome at reading, but it's I love what I've been given, a deeper level. It's kind of like I had a basic level, like maybe if you're at the library and you're in with the kiddie books, like I was in the early reader section, and now I'm like at the leveled reader section of music, but it's been fun. Yeah.
So now for your newest album release. So we're doing this interview actually a week before the release. So I haven't heard it yet, but I've bought the pre-sale on Bandcamp.
Oh,
But
I'll send it
when people hear this will have been released. So can you say a little bit about it and what the songs are about?
for sure. Yeah. This album is called Green Light, and it's kind of similar to Roddy's project in that it was made during the pandemic, but it doesn't have to do with the pandemic per se. It has to do with human emotions, like experienced during the pandemic, but like it could be any time, do you know what I mean? So nothing really, it's just about, the songs are about loneliness, mental health, supporting people through mental health struggles. It's about just love, love and love, love and longing. I think that's what I write about the most. And it's funny, like I realized just in the last little while, I've been just kind of doing a lot of reading, and like that's just gonna be me. Like that's just gonna be my story. Like love and longing is just part of it. And it makes sense, because like, I mean, I was this kid, this latchkey kid on my own, and a single with a single mom who was working 12-hour shifts, or nurses shifts, and like she was back to work, in 3 months. Like there was a time back when you didn't get like a year, to develop with your kid. So I spent a lot of time on my own. A lot of time reading, a lot of time wishing I had a brother or sister. I had a half brother, but he wasn't raised with me, and raised mostly in another country. So, and again, like not living near like a huge amount of family or anything, so there's just like there. I think there will always be in my music, like that longing, for connection and for human connection. Even and there it's funny, it's like makes me think of this line in one of the songs. It talks about loneliness in crowded rooms, like it's just that idea that like you could still be like you could be surrounded, you could be on a stage in front of like thousands of people and still have that inner loneliness. Yeah, so that's the new album.
So being alone at home during the pandemic, was your writing process a little different than when you're out touring all the time?
Yeah, it was different, because it's funny, like I like being alone to write. I actually prefer it. And I know like I've never loved co-writing situations where like the person's like right beside you, and like I've never really been like a team worker in that way. Like I just want to do my part, and then you bring your part, and then like, well, like I've had to learn how to be a team worker. But yeah, even if I was doing, like I remember when I was writing my part on Jane Bennett's album, which Embracing Voices, that album won the Juno, and so she gave me the the music, you know, and she was like, here you go. And I wrote my music, you know, on top of that. So my melody and my lyrics, and I need to like be able to kind of like ferret myself away and write. And I like to write, I'm thinking about it because I find the shower like is like a place for me. Like when I like to write in the shower. I loved, like when I did Embracing Voices, we were up at Banff Center and I went to the pool. I remember my kids were playing in the pool with, and my ex was watching them, and I was there trying to write because we had to record like the next day or something. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so behind. And so I'm writing this music. And it's again, that sound, you know, that sound when you're in a pool, you know, it's like that white noise. And I love writing on the, on common transport. I love writing on the plane. Mm-hmm. I love writing in the train, like the metro in Paris. And I know when I had to do, I remember when and come on, like in between going to the producer's house and working on the audio, I would just be, I would sometimes just ride the train, you know, and sit in the chair, in my seat and just like, you know, write that way. And so the thing that's kind of popping up for me is it's like, it doesn't need to be alone. Like I actually like the movement and the energy of the people around me, but I seem to like that white noise of, you know, the, of like the water or the train or the plane, that sound for some reason, I don't know. And I always wonder, people must think, cause I'll be sitting behind them in an airplane and I'll be singing into, like I'll be singing the melodies or singing the bass lines into my little, my iPhone recorder, you know, on the airplane. Mm-hmm. But it's a great place for me. Yeah. And so, right, you're asking how different. Yeah, like that did not happen in here. And it's funny because like I went to work, you know, at our common workplace. I knew I was going to be starting on a certain day and I knew that I was going to be busy. And I was like, I may not get this done, you know? So I had like these, I think it was like 3 or 4 weeks to get it written, to do the produce the tracks underneath, record like so they sounded the way that I wanted to before I gave them to the musicians, to get my vocals recorded on top, just like a scratch vocal, and then send it to them, get it back from them, and record my final vocal and the backing vocals over top. So that was the process of making this album, and all like in just in this little bedroom here. Mm-hmm. But all of it happened, you know, again, like it just kind of created this cocoon here in my dark room. Mm. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be really exciting to hear that album.
So I was telling you guys about this album that I performed or that we recorded called Nina, which was a tribute to the amazing music of Nina Simone. And this song is, it's her song. It's a song that I get to sing pretty much every night that I go out and do my show, because it's, you know, it's kind of like, as a jazz artist, it's kind of hard to have hits, but like, that's like what a lot of people would know me for, this song. And it also describes, you know, how I want to feel. And it's called Feeling Good. I'm flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom all the trees, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. Ooh, for me, for me. Ooh.
in the sand. You know what I mean, don't you know, don't you know? Butterflies are having fun. You know what I mean, sleep in peace. When day is done, that's what I mean. And this whole world, it's a new world and a bold world for me. Ooh. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Cinder and pine, you know how I feel. Freedom is mine, I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I feel so good, so good, so good.
Thank you so much for that. So beautiful.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
I just saw the movie about her, Nina Simone. It's so moving and disturbing.
Yeah, was it the documentary? What happened with Simone? Yeah.
Did you know that about her back when you made the album?
I think I didn't know the details. Like, I didn't know. I just knew that she, you know, she reminded me a lot of my grandma. You know, she was just like so forthright. And so she just tell it like it is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's funny. Like I would like to watch that movie again. Cause yeah, I mean, like if you have an undiagnosed mental health illness, you know, like it's not easy when you're diagnosed, you know, and to get the supports that you need and to find what you're looking for. When you think back to the time that she lived in, to just the access to services, plus like access to services on the road, if you're always on the road, and if people aren't necessarily looking out for your best interest, you know, taking you in, taking you off the road when you need to rest and make sure that you're okay. Like that's just not an ideal scenario. So yeah, I think I should watch that again and just kind of get a sense of like, you know, where she was at, just to even, I think that my compassion quotient would go up even more for her. But definitely like when I was making that album, I knew some things, but it was mainly, I don't even think we were as advanced as we are right now on our views on mental health, you know, even back in 2010 and 11 when I was making the album, you mm-hmm. know, like I think there's just we have a lot more compassion.
A lot more openness, a lot more information, hopefully.
For sure. Yeah. Different times and they keep growing and they keep evolving.
Yeah. Well, thanks for singing. That was just great.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks for asking. It makes me feel good too. Singing makes me happy.
So of course there'll be links in the description of this video for your website and all your current projects. And thank you so much for agreeing to this today.
Thank you so much. It was really an honor to get your note asking if we could do this together, and your questions, like they're deep, and I can see that you did a whole bunch of research, and I, you know, I'm really thankful for the opportunity to talk to you and yeah, and just before to learn a little bit about you.
Thanks. Okay. Take care.
You too. Take good care. And thank you again for having me.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.